Welcome to the deep dive. It's really great to have you with us today. Usually when we think about building a skyscraper or like a suspension bridge, there's this underlying assumption of total purity,
Right,
right?
absolutely.
Like you want the concrete to be perfectly mixed, the glass to be absolutely flawless, and the steel to be, well, strictly steel. I mean, if an engineer told you they were deliberately sprinkling a known chemical contaminant into the structural beams of your house, you would probably halt construction immediately.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it is a comforting way to look at the world, definitely. We tend to have this very binary view of materials, pure is good and safe, while contaminated is compromised and dangerous.
Right, it makes sense intuitively, but then you step into the world of atomic metallurgy, and suddenly that binary just completely shatters. So today, we are bringing you into a structural landscape that is, well, it's just full of
It
contradictions.
really is.
Yeah. We're looking at some brilliant research today from top materials science journals, specifically drawing on the foundational work of HKDH Padacia and DW So. And, their work is a perfect mission for our deep dive because it takes an old assumption and turns it completely upside down.
Yeah, it's a remarkable body of work because it challenges a fundamental dogma. Looking at how materials fail at the microscopic level, well, it often teaches us how to make them stronger. And in this case, we are looking at phosphorus.
Right, because for over a century, I mean, phosphorus has been viewed as the ultimate villain in steelmaking. It is a notorious impurity that makes metal incredibly brittle.
Extremely brittle, yeah.
Yeah, but the core question we want to explore with you today is, this is low phosphorus actually always a strict requirement? Or have we fundamentally misunderstood this so-called impurity all along?
Phosphorus is the perfect lens for this question because its behavior forces us to understand steel not just as a static solid block of metal, but as a dynamic living ecosystem of shifting atoms.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can figure out why anyone on Earth would actively want phosphorus in their steel, we have to understand the mechanics of how it destroys metal in the first place. And I mean, the villainy of phosphorus is not exactly breaking news, right?
No, not at all. It has been documented since at least 1860.
Wow, 1860.
Yeah. Even back then, engineers realized that a remarkably tiny amount of phosphorus, we're talking as little as 0.5%, would turn perfectly good forgeable bar iron, completely brittle.
Half a percent. I mean, that is practically nothing. It's like a single drop of food coloring ruining an entire gallon of water. How does something that minuscule cause a catastrophic failure in, say, a massive steel I-beam?
Well, to understand that, you have to visualize how metal is actually built. A solid piece of steel is not it's not one continuous unbroken matrix. If you look at it under a microscope, it's made up of countless microscopic crystals, which metallurgists call grains. And where these individual grains meet and like caress up against each other, you have what are called grain boundaries. These boundaries are essentially microscopic interfaces.
So if we picture the metal crystals as bricks, those grain boundaries are essentially the mortar holding the whole wall together.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it, yeah. Now, phosphorus has a very specific atomic quirk. It naturally prefers to segregate to those grain boundaries.
Why is that?
Because of its atomic size and bonding characteristics, it just doesn't fit comfortably inside the orderly matrix of the crystal itself. So as the steel forms, the phosphorus migrates to the edges straight into those interfaces.
Oh, I get it. So it's essentially like someone coming along and mixing sand into the mortar of our brick wall.
Exactly.
The bricks themselves, like the iron crystals, are perfectly fine, but the connections between them are becoming fundamentally compromised. And under high pressure, that wall isn't going to hold.
It will crumble. And it really doesn't take much sand to ruin the mortar. The research shows that when phosphorus covers just over 10% of the available atomic sites on these grain boundaries, which is a 0.1 atomic fraction, the material hits a very dangerous breaking point.
10% coverage is all it takes.
That's it. The stress required to fracture the metal along those boundaries drops drastically. Specifically, the intergranular fracture stress plummets from around 2300 megapascals down to about 1600 megapascals.
Wow. That is a massive sudden drop in structural integrity.
It is fatal for the steel. And this embrittlement is essentially a mechanical competition. You have two competing forces inside the metal when it's put under stress.
Okay, what are they?
On one hand, you have the stress required to rip those crystals apart at their boundaries. On the other hand, you have the general resistance of the metal to plastic flow, which is its yield strength.
Right, and plastic flow is just the metal's ability to stretch or bend without breaking, yeah.
Yes, exactly. If the force required to separate the weakened boundaries drops below the force required to make the metal bend, the metal doesn't bend, it just snaps.
It shatters like glass instead of flexing like a wire. Okay, so if phosphorus is acting like sand sneaking into the mortar while the steel cools down during manufacturing, a logical countermeasure jumps out to me.
What's that?
Well, segregation takes time, right? Atoms have to physically travel. So why don't we just cool the steel down so incredibly fast that the phosphorus simply doesn't have the time to travel to the boundaries, like freezing the sand in place before it reaches the mortar?
It makes perfect intuitive sense. Segregation requires diffusion, and diffusion requires time and ambient heat. The researchers decided to test that exact hypothesis.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, they took a binary alloy of iron containing 0.17% phosphorus by weight.
And they put this rapid cooling theory to the test.
They did. They heated the steel up to its austenitizing temperature, that is, the intense heat, where the steel's crystalline structure actually opens up, allowing atoms to move freely, and then they tried a variety of cooling rates.
How fast are we talking?
Well, they started very slow, cooling the metal at 1 Kelvin per second. And then they cranked it all the way up to a violent water quench, cooling the metal at an astonishing 400 Kelvin per second.
400 degrees Kelvin per second. That sounds like dropping a red-hot horseshoe straight into a bucket of liquid nitrogen. It is an incredibly violent thermal shock. But the fascinating part of this research is it completely failed.
Yeah, it failed to stop the segregation. Even at that extreme cooling rate of 400 Kelvin per second, the amount of phosphorus that piled up at the grain boundaries was still at 80% of the maximum level they saw at the slow, 1 Kelvin per second rate.
That's wild.
Yeah, specifically, they measured a 0.118 atomic fraction at the fast rate, compared to a 0.146 atomic fraction at the slow rate.
Wait, I need to wrap my head around this. If the temperature is dropping that fast, how is it physically possible for the phosphorus to travel to the boundaries? It shouldn't have the thermal energy to move.
It has to do with when the phosphorus is moving. The critical insight from the researchers is that the phosphorus isn't diffusing after the steel transforms into its final state. It is moving during the phase transformation itself.
During the transformation.
Right. As the steel cools, it changes from a high-temperature structure called austenite into a lower-temperature structure called ferrite.
Wait, so it's not sneaking in after the house is built? It's riding the wave of the construction itself.
That's the core mechanism. As the boundary between the newly forming ferrite phase and the shrinking austenite phase sweeps across the metal, the phosphorus is literally dragged along with that growing transformation front.
That is incredible.
It's like a surfer riding a wave. During that phase change, the atomic spike of phosphorus keeps perfect pace with the moving boundary, regardless of how fast you're cooling the overall material.
And once that wave crashes, like once the transformation into ferrite is finished?
Once the transformation is done, the phosphorus is basically stuck. The diffusion distance of phosphorus in that final ferrite state is incredibly tiny, only about 0.37 micrometers. It can't move far enough to matter anymore.
Right.
But the damage is already done. That surfing process during the phase change is what concentrates the impurity at the boundaries.
Which means rapid cooling is a dead end for solving this problem in high phosphorus alloys. You literally cannot outrun it. So if we can't outrun the phosphorus during the manufacturing process, it feels like any piece of steel with even a trace of phosphorus in it is doomed to shatter.
What's fascinating here is that this is exactly where our conventional logic starts to unravel, because they aren't all doomed. The physical strength of the steel matrix itself actually flips our expectations upside down.
I think I see where you're going. Let's go back to that mechanical competition you mentioned earlier, you know, the race between the boundaries ripping apart and the metal simply bending.
Right.
If you have a very strong steel, one with a yield strength over, say, 1500 megapascals, that internal matrix is incredibly rigid. It just doesn't want to bend.
Exactly. Because high-strength steels are so stiff, they cannot absorb much energy by deforming. When you apply stress to them, they transfer almost all of that force directly to the weakest links.
Which, thanks to our surfer friend phosphorus, are those compromised grain boundaries. So the boundaries take the full hit and the metal snaps.
High-strength steels are highly susceptible to phosphorus embrittlement for that exact reason. But consider low-strength steels, those with a yield strength under 600 megapascals. These have a much softer matrix.
Okay, so because the matrix is softer, it acts like a shock absorber. It can accommodate the physical strain by stretching and bending rather than passing all that stress to the weak boundaries.
It absorbs the energy, it yields. It's the difference between trying to bend a dry, brittle twig versus a fresh green branch.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, the dry twig transfers the stress to a microscopic weak point and snaps, but the green branch just flexes.
And because the steel can flex, it can actually tolerate much higher concentrations of phosphorus safely.
Not only tolerate it, but benefit from it. The steel industry does something that seems completely crazy on paper. In certain automotive steels, known as interstitial free steels, phosphorus is added on purpose.
Okay, let me pause you there. Interstitial free. That means the microscopic empty spaces, the interstices between the iron atoms have been cleared of straggler atoms like carbon or nitrogen, right? Making the steel incredibly soft and easy to press into shapes like car doors.
That is correct. But you still need the car door to have some baseline strength so it doesn't dent when you just lean on it. So they deliberately add around 0.05 to 0.1% phosphorus by weight.
Really?
Yeah. In this specific environment, phosphorus acts as an incredible solid solution strengthener. It increases the overall strength and the work hardening capacity of the ferrite without ruining the metal's ability to be formed and pressed.
That is wild, because the baseline matrix is weak enough to handle the stress. The impurity stops being a catastrophic flaw and becomes a performance enhancer.
Precisely.
But, you know, this raises a major issue. Low-strength steel is great for a car hood, but what if we have to build high-strength steel? Say we are building a pressure vessel for a nuclear reactor or a deep-sea submarine.
Right.
We need that massive 1,500 megapascal strength, and we cannot afford the steel to be soft. If we can't outrun the phosphorus and we can't just absorb the stress, what do we do?
Then you are facing a serious engineering challenge. You only have one real option left. You have to fight the phosphorus chemically by guarding the grain boundaries.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If we think of those grain boundaries as a VIP section, with a very limited number of seats, and phosphorus is the obnoxious guest we want to keep out. Wait, do we just flood the VIP section with a different element that takes up all the space first?
You're hitting on the core mechanism. It's called site competition. We introduce elements that want to sit in those green boundary spaces even more than phosphorus does.
Oh, brilliant.
And the primary hero in this story is carbon. Carbon segregates to ferric green boundaries 100 times more strongly than phosphorus. It simply outcompetes it for the available atomic real estate.
So it just bullies it out of the way.
Yeah, pretty much. By adding just a tiny amount of carbon, anything over 0.008% by weight, the carbon floods the boundaries, takes up the sites, and physically blocks the phosphorus from settling there.
It fills the seats. But carbon isn't our only tool, right? The research highlights a few microalloying elements like titanium and niobium. Do they compete for seats at the boundary too?
Titanium and niobium operate a little differently. Instead of racing to the boundary to block the seats, they interact with the phosphorus out in the main matrix.
Okay, how so?
When titanium and niobium are in solid solution, they essentially put chemical handcuffs on the phosphorus. They pin it down within the matrix, preventing it from ever migrating to the boundary in the first place. The research shows they can reduce phosphorus segregation by up to fourfold.
That sounds like a massive win. We just throw some titanium in the mix and the problem is solved.
You would think so, but there is a major catch. Titanium and niobium are notorious carbide formers. They have a massive chemical affinity for carbon.
Oh, I see the collision course here. We need carbon to block the boundaries, and we need titanium to handcuff the phosphorus in the matrix. But if they are both in the steel, they are just going to react with each other.
They do. If you have carbon in the steel, the titanium and niobium will react with it to form highly stable compounds called titanium carbide or niobium carbide. And when they form those compounds, they're pulled out of solid solution.
Meaning?
They drop the chemical handcuffs. They stop pinning the phosphorus.
That is a double disaster. You lose the pinning effect of the titanium because it's distracted by the carbon, and you tie up the carbon so it can't act as a seat filler at the grain boundaries.
Exactly. It temporarily ruins the protective effect of both elements. The only way engineers can fix it is by calculating a very delicate chemical balancing act. They have to add enough excess carbon to satisfy all the titanium and niobium while ensuring there is still enough free carbon left over to go block the boundaries again.
Wow, it is a microscopic balancing act. And speaking of delicate chemistry, we have to talk about the molybdenum mystery, because the researchers point out that molybdenum is doing something entirely different, and nobody seems to agree on what it actually is.
Molybdenum is fascinating. It is routinely added to commercial steels, usually around 0.7% by weight. specifically because it practically eliminates grain boundary embrittlement from phosphorus.
That's a huge deal.
It is incredibly effective. But as you mentioned, the scientific community is heavily divided on exactly how it works. There are essentially two warring camps.
A scientific civil war over a steel additive. What is the debate?
Well, one camp believes molybdenum acts as a chemical scavenger. They argue that molybdenum actively bonds with phosphorus in the matrix, creating a complex that prevents the phosphorus from segregating to the boundaries. Very similar to what titanium does.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. What does the other camp say?
The other camp argues that molybdenum doesn't stop the phosphorus from segregating at all. They believe the phosphorus still goes to the boundary, but the molybdenum also segregates to the boundary right alongside it.
Oh, so they meet up there.
Right. And once it's there, the physical size of the molybdenum atoms, or perhaps the nature of their electron bonding, intrinsically strengthens the boundary. Essentially, they argue the molybdenum creates a stronger mortar that completely cancels out the weakening effect of the sand.
So one side says it stops the phosphorus from arriving, and the other side says it lets the phosphorus arrive but neutralizes the damage on site. And we still don't definitively know which is true.
We still don't fully understand the exact atomic mechanism. The chemistry is incredibly difficult to isolate. But from an engineering standpoint, we know the optimal dose works wonders.
It's like having a mysterious fixer on the payroll. We don't ask how he cleans up the mess, we just know the building doesn't fall down. Okay, so let's recap where we are. We've tried outrunning the phosphorus with rapid cooling, and we found out it surfs the phase change. We've tried absorbing its stress with weak interstitial free matrices. We've tried fighting it chemically with carbon site competition and molybdenum. But the researchers highlight one final absolute genius metallurgical trick.
And this is perhaps the most elegant solution of all, because it attacks the premise of the problem.
Right. Because if the phosphorus insists on congregating at the grain boundaries, what if we just completely obliterate the boundaries?
This brings us to TRIP-assisted steels. TRIP-P stands for transformation-induced plasticity. It's a type of steel that actually gets stronger the more it deforms, which is incredible for absorbing impact in car crashes.
That sounds super advanced.
It is. And these alloys can tolerate incredibly high phosphorus levels, up to 0.2% by weight, without falling apart.
How do they pull that off? How do you destroy a grain boundary?
The secret lies in a specific microstructural feature called allotriomorphic ferrite. In a standard phase transformation, the new crystal structures nucleate and grow confined inside the borders of the original high-temperature austenite grains. They leave the original grain boundaries intact.
Leaving that high-energy real estate exactly where the phosphorus wants to go and cause trouble.
But allotriomorphic ferrite is completely different. It forms by a diffusional mechanism that actually nucleates at those original boundaries, and then it grows across them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As the ferrite grows, it physically consumes the prior austenite grain boundaries. It destroys the exact high-energy interfaces where phosphorus historically wants to segregate.
It's like rezoning a neighborhood. If all the trouble is happening in the alleys between the buildings, you just bulldoze the alleys and build a massive park over the whole block. The physical space where the phosphorus wants to gather simply ceases to exist.
That is exactly what happens on an atomic level. Because those classical boundaries are consumed, the microstructure becomes drastically less sensitive to impurity-enhanced embrittlement. The vulnerability is quite literally erased.
That's incredible.
But it gets even better. In TRIP steels, the phosphorus actually shifts from being a tolerated nuisance to an active stabilizing ally.
Wait, let's take that a step further. How does an impurity actively stabilize a high-tech steel?
Well, a key feature of TRIP steels is the presence of retained austenite. These are tiny pockets of the high-temperature crystal phase that are intentionally preserved in the metal even after it cools to room temperature.
Okay, and why do we want those?
This retained austenite is what gives the steel its incredible plasticity and ability to absorb energy, but it is very fragile. If a compound called cementite forms during the cooling process, it will destroy that retained austenite.
And cementite is basically a hard, brittle iron carbide compound that ruins flexibility.
Exactly.
So we want to stop cementite from forming. Let me guess, phosphorus prevents cementite.
It does. Phosphorus strongly retards the formation of cementite. By inhibiting that brittle compound, the phosphorus directly protects and stabilizes the highly desirable retained austenite in the microstructure. If we connect this to the bigger picture, by changing the geographic architecture of the crystal boundaries, an old enemy is drafted into becoming a vital collaborator.
So what does this all mean for us? I mean, if we step back from the microscope, this deep dive completely upends how we think about the very concept of an impurity. Phosphorus is not just a universally toxic element. Whether it ruins a piece of steel or dramatically enhances, it depends entirely on a complex, beautifully choreographed dance.
It is entirely contextual. It depends on the physical strength of the matrix and its ability to accommodate strain. It depends on the thermal history and the surfing effect during phase transformations. And it depends on the presence of chemical balancers, like carbon or molybdenum, competing for real estate.
The flaw in one context is the critical load-bearing feature in another.
And this raises an important question, one that I think extends far beyond metallurgy. In our modern technological race, across almost every discipline, we are obsessed with creating ultra-pure, flawless materials. We spend billions of dollars trying to eliminate every microscopic defect. But what if we are actually limiting ourselves by adhering to that binary mindset?
That's a huge point. If an infamous century-old contaminant like phosphorus can be actively harnessed to make modern automotive steel stronger and more formable, what else are we missing? Could the microscopic defects we are currently trying to aggressively eliminate in other fields, like the tiny imperfections in semiconductor crystals or the chemical impurities in next-generation solid-state batteries, could those actually be the hidden, vital ingredients of tomorrow's breakthroughs? Are we accidentally purifying away our next great leap forward because we're too afraid of a little contamination?
It's definitely something we need to be asking ourselves.
That is a phenomenal thought to leave on. If the sand in the mortar can actually be engineered to make the skyscraper stronger, we might need to rethink everything we know about building the future. Thank you so much for exploring this with us. It has been an absolute mind-bender to walk through this atomic landscape with you.
The pleasure was mine. The structures are microscopic, but the implications are massive.
Until next time, keep questioning the impurities and keep looking for the strength and the flaws. See you on the next deep dive.